Silence. The sound of two people breathing. I felt a wet nose at my ear, saw Molly poking her head up, wagging her tail, bouncing back and forth on her paws, growling low under her breath. Amy said, "They can't get us. They can't get us in the light. I knew it." "How did you—" "David," she said, rolling her eyes, "they're shadow people." She rolled down her window, poked her head out into the night and screamed, "Screw you!" "Amy, I'd prefer that you not do that." She pulled back in and said, "My heart's going 1,000 miles an hour. I looked out into the nothing, found the gun in my lap, and squeezed it. A good luck charm at this point, and barely that. Amy said, "Oh, look at that. What is—" Little bits of light, moving around in the darkness in pairs. Twin embers, small as lit cigarettes, floating slowly around us. There were a few, and then a few more, until dozens of the fiery eyes were peering in at us. And then, through the windshield, I saw color. A thin line of electric blue across the darkness, like a horizon. Then the blue line grew fat in the middle, expanding, widening like a slit cut in black cloth. It expanded until the blue was all that was visible through the windshield. It was an eye. The eye. Vibrant blue, with a dark, vertical reptilian slit of a pupil. The hand on my forearm again. I thought Amy was going to break the bone with her grip. The eye twitched, taking us in. Then it blinked and was gone. The shroud of blackness was gone, too. Just the night now. Shrouded stars and moonlit snow, and a sad, dormant donut shop. Amy said, Are they gone? They're never gone. What was that? Well, you see, Amy, it's like this. We are under the eye of Korok, we are his food, and our screams are his Tabasco sauce. Instead, I said, I'm not leaving the light. No. Amy craned her head around, looking in all directions again, then took off the cardboard glasses. I looked down at the Smith and realized something, probably several minutes too late. I grabbed the barrel and offered it to Amy, but first, I whispered, take this. What? No. Amy, that thing with the truck driver? You saw how they took him over, used his body? Well, that same thing can happen to me. And don't ask how I know that, honey. No. David. Amy, listen to me. If I start acting weird, if I make a move at you, you need to shoot me. I wouldn't even know how to... It's not complicated. The safety is off. Just squeeze. And don't get cute and try to go for my arm or some shit like that. You'll miss. Just aim for the middle of me. Jam it into my ribs. Shoot and get out. Run for it. Don't, you know, keep shooting me. Please take it. To my surprise, she did. She turned the pistol over, the gun looking huge in her little hand. She said, well, what if it happens to me? What if they take me instead? I can overpower you if I have to. Get the gun away. But I don't think it'll happen, not with you. Why? I leaned back, suddenly feeling lighter without the gun. I swear the things generate their own gravity. It's just a theory I have. Amy pulled her feet up on the seat and scrunched against me, shivering. The gun was in her right hand, laying across her hip and pointing vaguely at my crotch. There would be some real symbolism here, I thought, if this turned out to be a dream. I said, besides, I don't need the gun. I held up my hands and said, they passed a law that said I couldn't put my hands in my pockets. Do you know why? Because they would become concealed weapons. I can kill a man with these hands, or just one of my feet. She snorted a dry, nervous laugh and said, yeah, okay. I'll watch out for you then. I again gripped the steering wheel with both hands, tendons tensing across my forearms like cables. I sat like that in silence for an eternity of minutes, a whole bunch of words trapped behind clenched teeth. Finally, I closed my eyes and said, okay, look, you need to understand something about this situation, who you're trapped in here with. Okay. She twisted around to face me. Those eyes were so damn green, like a cat. Don't just listen. Do you know why I was in the special school while I was in the BD class in Pineview? She said, sort of. The thing with Billy, right? The fight you got into with him? And then later when he... Yes, that's right. Listen, men are animals. Get us together, take out the authority figures, and it's Lord of the Flies. Billy and his gang, A couple of guys on the wrestling team. They used to make these videos. The kid, you know, the Patterson kid? Kind of fat? Anyway, they got him after school and tied him to a goalpost and shaved his head and all of that. And it was hours before somebody found him. And by then, you know, the skin on his face was all blistered from contact with the feces. Maybe you can cut back on the details a bit, hmm? And they have this party, and they show the tape. Show the tape of them torturing this fat kid and him just screaming. And they sat there with their beers and watched that tape over and over and over, and that's the way it is in high school. Shit that would get an adult put in a straitjacket is just brushed off. Boys will be boys. I hesitated, scanned the night for something, anything. I saw a lone bird on a power line, flapping its wings, but it didn't seem to be going anywhere. Anyway, the Hitchcock guys. I had gym with them, and they picked me out of the crowd. It became this daily thing, little shit at first, but they kept pushing it further and further, and it took more and more to keep them entertained. And the coach there, he hated me, so he would make sure and not be there. I mean, I literally saw him turn his back and leave the room when they came after me one time, made sure I saw him do it. And one day they got on me and took me to this equipment room and back, this little storage area with shoulder pads and wrestling mats stacked all around, and it's hot as an oven. And there's this moldy smell of old sweat fermenting in foam padding. And things got crazy, like prison yard crazy. And eventually it ends, and they leave me there, and they're walking out through the locker room, and, would she notice if I suddenly changed the subject? Well, I had taken to bringing a knife to school. Not a switchblade or anything cool, but a little 2-inch blade on my keychain. It was all I had. And I get this blade free, and I get behind Billy, and I slice him. Right up his back. A shallow little cut up his spine. It wasn't deep, but it got his attention, and he fell over, thinking he was dead, blood all over the bench and the floor. And I got on him, sat on his chest, and I started jabbing at his face, cutting, the blade bouncing off bone in his forehead and blood and... I thought long and hard about how to dress up this next part, but couldn't think of a way. I wondered when the donut shop was scheduled to open. Filling in the silence, Amy asked, "What did they do to you?" "Let's put it this way. I'll never, ever tell you." She had no answer, which either meant she was totally unfamiliar with the concept or very well familiar. I pressed on. So I wound up cutting out his eyes, hurting him pretty bad. He lost his eyesight. I mean, like, legally blind. I wound up getting charged with aggravated assault and several other things that are all synonyms for aggravated assault. The school was talking a permanent expulsion. My dad, my adoptive dad, he's a lawyer, you know. He had a series of meetings with the school and the prosecutor, and it was a mess. They wound up testing me for mental illness, which I knew even at the time was a way to get me off, because the case could be made that the school should have protected Billy from me, should have diagnosed me, whatever. I met with a counselor who had me talk about my mom and look at ink blots and role-play with puppets and draw a picture of how I viewed my place in the world. And I knew it was a scam, a lawyer trick. But I kept picturing Coach Wilson turning his back again and again. And I figured, hey, screw them. The prosecutor, this bearded Jewish tough guy, didn't want to push the charges. He said it was a 5-on-1 fight and shit happens. Didn't want to see me disappear into the jaws of the juvie justice system. The school backed off on the expulsion under threat of lawsuit, and bada boom, I wind up spending my final year at Pineview. A speck of crystal landed on the windshield, a lone snowflake. Another landed a few inches away. So, I said, 4 months later, Billy is adjusting to life without eyes, saying goodbye to sports and driving and independence and knowing what his food looks like before he eats it, and never knowing if a fly has landed in his soup. He takes all of his pain pills at once. Demerol, I think. They find him dead the next day. Silence. Desperate to hear her say something, anything, I asked. So how much of that story did you already know? Most of it. There was a weird rumor that went around that you had snuck into his room and poisoned him or something stupid like that, with rat poison or something, which was stupid because the police would have noticed that. Right. Right. I started that rumor, by the way. You must have felt horrible when you found out. About Billy, I mean. That'd be awful. Yeah. Nope. What followed was the longest and most tense conversation pause of my life, like being stuck on a Ferris wheel with somebody you just puked on. Exactly like that, by the way. The truth was, I didn't feel sorry for Billy. He teased a dog and got his fingers bitten off. Fuck him. Fuck everybody. And fuck you, Amy, for somehow getting me to tell you this. Sure, yeah, I felt bad about it, Your Honor. And that day years ago when I heard about the kids shooting up the school in Colorado, I shook my head and said it was a tragedy, an awful tragedy. But inside, I was thinking the look on the jocks' faces when they saw the guns must have been fucking priceless. So yeah, as far as you know, I felt just as bad about Billy as a good person would, and I'll never, ever tell you otherwise. Never. She said, still, who knows what he would have done to somebody else if you hadn't... I don't feel bad about it, Amy. I lied about that part. When I heard, I felt nothing at all. I thought I would. I didn't. The guilt just wasn't there because I'm not that type of person. And that's what I've been saying. That's why you're in danger here. I don't think those things, those bits of walking nothing can use you. But I think they'd know me as one of their own. So keep the gun on me. And keep your finger alongside of the trigger and be ready to squeeze it as hard and as fast as you can. Silence again. Did I say that last silence was the longest and most awkward of my life? The record didn't stand for long. I would give everything I own to somehow take this conversation back. I said, we have no idea what they were doing to you, Amy. When those things took you all those times. But they're not going to do it again. This being scared bullshit, it's exhausting for me. And you know, I reach a point where I say, you can kill me or tear off my arms or soak me in gasoline and set me on fire, but you won't keep me like this, imprisoned by fear. Now, after everything I've seen, I'm not really scared of monsters and demons and whatever they are. I'm only scared of one thing, and that's the fear. Living with that fear, the intimidation, a boot on my neck. I won't live like that. I won't. I wouldn't then, and I won't now. After a long time, she said, what do we do? We sit here. Just keep the gun on me, okay? We'll sit here and wait for the sun. Then I'll talk to John. John will know what to do. I can't believe you just said that. Chapter 14. John Investigates. 4:20 a.m. John had decided to go to the drain rooter job site early to get a look around on his own. So while Amy and I sat camped out in my Bronco at the Unborn Donut Shop, John was rolling his caddy up the snowy road past Amy's house. He didn't get far, of course, arriving at a bundle of vehicles trying to unstick a jackknife drain rooter semi-tractor trailer. Now, I wasn't there, so this story is hearsay. If you know John, you'll take the details for what they're worth. Please also remember that where John claims to have gotten up at 3:30 to perform this investigation, it was far more likely he was still up and somewhat drunk from the night before. John says he pulled up to the scene, which was roped off with yellow and black tape that announced it as a hazardous material area. Several guys in yellow jumpsuits were milling around and cleaning the scene with some urgency, so of course he immediately decided to cross the Do Not Cross tape. 2 steps in, John found himself standing on a faded pink stain on the snow, as wide as a car. He deduced that this was blood, though the truck driver's body was gone. He stood over this large bloodstain and said out loud and in the presence of several bystanders, "This is blood. David must have been here." At this point, 2 elderly security guards in parkas, the guys who normally work the front desk at the plant, asked John to step behind the tape. John claims that here he told the guards that he could not speak English, and when this failed to persuade them, he faked a violent seizure. I am unclear as to the purpose of this part of his plan. John flung himself down and began rolling around in the snow, thrashing his limbs about and screaming, "El seizure no es bueno," in a Mexican accent. 6 pairs of boots came mushing through the snow toward him. From the ground, John saw something that stopped him cold. The semi-trailer was, according to him, bleeding from the ass. John saw gallons of a red liquid running freely from the rear cargo doors of the truck, pooling on the road below, the stuff almost black in the moonlight. Several gloved hands seized him and dragged him through the snow, men in jumpsuits and protective masks. John squinted through the bustling team of men around the truck and saw several guys haul out a couple of blue plastic barrels, stained on the sides with the red substance that now seemed a little more like transmission fluid than blood, dark and thick and oily. Right behind them, several casket-shaped boxes were hauled out, the men carrying them like pallbearers. John stressed that these containers were not caskets, but were merely casket-shaped, coated with several stickers that seemed to indicate some kind of biohazard. Not the sort of thing you would use to ship bottles of household chemical to the local True Value. Here's where things get hazy. John claims that the men hauling him away from the scene were escorted by other men carrying submachine guns, though when pressed, he admitted they may have been flashlights. Either way, John says the men threw him down and intended to execute him, at which point he kicked one of the men in the face and backflipped to his feet. He then wrestled away the man's gun and dick-whipped him with it. I am unclear as to whether or not this means he struck the man in the groin or merely slapped him in the same manner in which he would slap a person with his dick. I never asked John to clarify such things. Anyway, he said he swung again and slammed another man's skull with the gun so hard it made the batteries fly out. Next, according to John, of course, in one continuous motion, he triple-kicked a third man in the face while shooting a fourth right in his damned cock. John, of course, knew that he couldn't leave that man just lying there, screaming in pain, so he grasped him by the sides of his face and mercifully snapped his neck with a sharp twisting motion of his bare hands. At this point, John says the rest of the hazard workers noticed what was going on, and a chase ensued. He escaped by stealing a nearby horse. This is the first inconsistency in John's account, because when the story picks up, he is calmly driving his caddy back down the road, past Amy's house, and away from the Reuter plant. I suspect that in reality, either the men at the cleanup site didn't see John at all, or they merely gave him a dirty look until he turned around and drove away. Again, I wasn't there, and I do not wish to cast an unfavorable light on John's personal credibility. Undaunted, John turned off on a country road not far from the house. He wasn't the first to have this idea tonight, he figured, because there were tire tracks in the snow leading up, and John figured the last person who came this way was doing what he was doing, getting around the accident. A few minutes in, he became sure he was right because the road seemed to circle back around to the rear of the old industrial park, which contained the Reuter plant along with an abandoned Beans and Weenies cannery, a Best Buy distribution center, and a closed Hanes Jockstrap Jockstrappery. Just across the highway from that was the abandoned undisclosed shopping center with its rows of decaying stores where the only inventory was mildew, bats, and squirrel families building nests out of used rubbers. The gravel road and fresh tire tracks that John followed took him through a narrow strip of woods alongside the Reuter property. It was while passing through the leafy darkened canopy that he saw a flickering of lights off to his left, flashing between the tree trunks. He slowed and stopped, seeing bouncing white beams that had to be men with flashlights, maybe a half dozen or so. Shots rang out. The lights vanished, and John sat there for a few minutes before he picked them up again, farther down in the trees. He pulled forward a little down the road, peering into the woods, saw the flashlight beams stop, and then blink out one by one. Whatever the men were looking for, be it a raccoon to boil or one of the guy's contact lenses, they had apparently found it. He peered into the trees looking for more activity, decided that the group could have been mere redneck poachers or fraternity scavenger hunters, and stepped on the gas. The big caddy crested a hill, and when John saw what was below, he slammed on the brakes. A truck was down there. A heavy truck that looked military but didn't have a military paint job. Flat black from head to toe. This was apparently the source of the tire tracks he had been following. A group of men carrying what had to be rifles stood around the vehicle, and John immediately reached out and punched the switch to kill his headlights. Then it occurred to him that the light suddenly going off might have been more noticeable, so he punched them back on. Thought he saw two of the men turn toward him, and then quickly turn the lights back off again. Now he felt the strobing of his headlights was almost impossible not to notice. In fact, all of the men seemed to be looking up the hill at him. The group might have either pursued him or raised their rifles to perforate his windshield had a gorilla riding a giant crab not leapt out of the woods and eaten two of them. You heard me. John said the thing was as tall as the truck and walked on six legs that looked horned and armored like something seen at a seafood buffet. But there was part that had the feel of a mammal, too, fur and arms. Please remember that from John's distance the beast would have been the size of a dime, so I won't criticize his crab-riding monkey description, even though we all know it's retarded. The thing crawled away, sideways, with the legs of one man still kicking from its mandibles. Cracks of rifle shots rang out and little flares of muzzle flash lit up the snow at the foot of the hill. The men raced into the woods. John waited, then threw the caddy into reverse and backed far enough down the other side of the hill as to be out of the view of the army truck. Though he claims that from that vantage point he could still see the truck, so that's probably physically impossible. Shots rang out from the woods. An animal screech rang out from the woods. Shots rang out from the woods again. More howls, and then more shots, dozens rattling over each other. Full auto fire. screams. There was silence for a moment, and then John says he saw a single figure sprint out of the woods and head to the truck. The man jumped into the back, pulled out two small cases the size of lunchboxes, and ran into the woods again. After a moment, more shots hammered the night air. The bestial screams again. More shots. More screams. More shots. There was a low animal moan from the woods. The gunfire fell silent. John threw the caddy in gear and was prepared to drive past the truck before the men returned. But he was too late, because here was the lone man running back. He was carrying the small cases, which seemed lighter now. He ducked into the truck again, emerged with two new cases, and returned to the woods. Gunshots resumed, followed by the screams of the monkey crab. This went on for about half an hour, and then finally the noises stopped. Four men wandered out of the woods and mounted up in the truck. The truck pulled away. John followed. He passed a turn that led back to the drain rooter plant, probably to the employee lot, but saw that it was sealed off with a chain-link gate. If this had been an action movie, John thought, he would have rammed through it. Unlike a movie prop car, however, John was depending on the Cadillac to get him to work the next morning, and a punctured radiator would cost a week's pay. But more importantly, the truck he was following didn't turn off at the gated road, and he was now very eager to see where it went. John hung far back, content to follow the trail of the tire tracks. They kept going through the main access road for the industrial park and across the two-lane highway that intersected the road. The truck had continued onto the white canvas that was the parking lot of the dead, undisclosed mall. It had circled around to the back of the eastern wing, one fork in the mall's U-shaped floor plan. John waited what he thought was a sufficient amount of time for the men in the truck to dismount and go wherever they were going, then cautiously drove around the building so he could see the truck parked near the ramp and boarded up entrance of what would have been a department store had the mall ever bothered to open. John staked out the spot, saw nothing. He finally grew impatient and, being totally unarmed and without a flashlight or any kind of survival instincts, tromped over to a doorless doorway and walked in like he owned the place. The cavernous space was as cold as a meat locker. Some moonlight spilled in from a framed hole in the roof, the skylight that had the glass shattered out of it last year. Snow had sifted down through the hole, leaving a coating at the center of the floor like spilled flour. Right across the edge of it were footprints, five or six leading to an elongated skid that John assumed was created by a guy slipping in the snow and falling on his ass. John didn't make the same mistake, circling around the dusting of snow and following the direction of the tracks. They led to a metal maintenance door, and John paused to wonder if maintenance on this place was the easiest job in the world, or the hardest. He found the door locked and claims he picked it. I've never known John to know how to pick a lock, but I don't claim to know all of his secrets. Maybe the guys just left it unlocked. Anyway, John says he picked it, and inside found a small, dirty, windowless room that seemed to be home to a lot of spiderwebs and dark scurrying shapes, but no exits. He flicked on his lighter and confirmed it. No doors. No hatches. No tunnels. Just like Amy's bathroom, the trail led there and stopped. John turned to leave, and out of the corner of his eye, he saw a doorway. He felt like an idiot because how do you miss it right in the middle of the wall like that? Tall, arched at the top, ornate. Totally out of place in a room like this. Then he turned to face it and saw that it was only a blank wall again. He turned to the side, once more saw a blurry glimpse of the big door out of the corner of his eye. There, but not there, like an optical illusion. John went over to the wall and pawed around on the surface by the warm glow of the butane flame, looking for a lever or a seam or hidden hinges or something. After several minutes, he found it only to be a solid wall. He glanced at his watch, 5:06 a.m., and realized he had to be at the job site in less than half an hour. He left, guessing, rightly, that he would be back. 5:18 a.m. I alternately turned the Bronco's engine on and off so we could run the heater without poisoning ourselves with carbon monoxide, as I heard could happen if a parked car was left on too long. Especially this one, which smelled like rotten eggs from time to time anyway. I had always credited it to some sort of emissions problem, and I was sure it would remain even if I gave the truck a thorough cleaning, though I had never fully investigated that scenario. Amy's hair smelled like strawberries. She was leaning on me, her feet on the armrest of the door, the gun pointed somewhere in the direction of the glove compartment. There was a coating of white on all of the glass now, as if a sheet had been thrown over the Bronco. For the second time that night, I had the very odd, weightless feeling that we were the last two people on Earth. I said, "Can I ask you something?" "Nope." "Why were you in Pineview? There's barely anything wrong with you. And I have a right to know, you know, as a taxpayer." "The car accident. I missed school for a few months, had all kinds of problems when I came back. They had me on antidepressants and everything else. Wellbutrin. I bit a teacher and wound up with the crazy kids."
"You bit a teacher?"
She sighed and said, "Okay, one day me and Mom and Dad were driving, going shopping for school clothes. I was 14, about to start high school. I fell asleep in the back seat and woke up and felt like somebody was shaking me. Then I was upside down, my cheek pressed to the pavement. Glass everywhere, blood everywhere. Dad had been thrown from the car. He died right there, 2 feet in front of me. His face was just, it was like a rubber mask, just nothing there. Mom was laying there, legs pinned under the hood, screaming. I was mostly okay, but my back was twisted around and my legs were numb and my hand was caught under a door, and I just laid there and told Mom to calm down and that help would be here soon. We laid there forever. And I could hear cars passing. I could hear them, and it's like, why don't they stop? Somebody, you'd think." She trailed off, turned to look out the side window at nothing. "They pulled me out, and my hand was like a hamburger, tendons and stuff curling out of it, and just gross. It was just barely on, hanging by like a little strip holding it to my wrist. They're putting me on a stretcher, and my hand is just dangling, swinging back and forth. Mom died at the hospital. Jim wasn't there, of course. He had stayed home, so he was okay, and he was freaking out like it was his fault. They did surgery on my hand, put it back on. Then they did surgery on my back, where I cracked a vertebrae. They put a little metal rod right..." She reached around and pointed to a spot between her shoulder blades. "There. It made me a half inch taller. Isn't that weird? I had a lot of pain. They'd put me in traction every now and then to kind of stretch me out and take pressure off it. And so the hand, it was a big problem. It worked for a few years into high school, but then I lost the feeling in these two fingers. Amy did something very creepy, which was to hold up her stump and point to a spot in space where the last two fingers would be. And they did surgery again, and again. The pain was unbelievable. That and my back, and I was on these pills, pain pills, every 4 hours, and they made me sick, constantly. So they'd lower my dosage, but those would wear off, and I'd spend the last 2 hours counting the minutes to pill time again. So I was having to live with either the pain or the puking, and I kind of had to pick. Antidepressants. The thought of this girl actually being depressed made me want to grab the whole planet and throw it into the sun. Well, more than usual, anyway. And I bit a teacher, so eventually my fingers went numb again, almost all of them, and I couldn't grip anything. I was dropping things. They had me staying with Uncle Bill and Aunt Betty, and they were in the process of splitting up, and they didn't want me there. One time I dropped this glass thing, this little figurine, and Bill freaked out. I mean, it's not his fault they didn't want me, but what could I do? He yelled. And anyway, the doctor said we had one last shot, one last chance to get the hand to work because the nerve tissue was dying off. She looked down and picked something off her sock. So they did the surgery, and I woke up in the recovery room, and I was half out of it, and I was dreaming that my hand was gone. And I woke up, and there it was. Gone. Just an empty space. White sheets where my hand should be. It looked so weird. I cried and cried and cried, just bawling for hours. They knew, David, they knew they'd have to take the hand off, and they didn't say anything. And I was just lying there, and I knew all at once that I'd never be able to blend into a room again. You know? I grunted. And no matter what I did or what I said, it'd always be Amy, you know, the girl without a hand, everywhere I went. And the worst part is when you, like, meet somebody new and they don't notice the hand right away. They don't see it. And you sit there talking to them and you're just waiting, anticipating that moment when they're going to notice. That look in their eyes at the moment they see it. Like they're embarrassed for me. She went quiet. I said, "This world kind of sucks." I left. I went and stayed with Jim after that. I can still feel the hand, you know. It's true what they say about that ghost feeling and the limb and all that.
What, it itches or something?
No, it's like clenched. I can feel my hand clenching and I can't release it. Isn't that weird? She held up her good hand, squeezed in a tight fist. Like this, I can actually feel the fingernails digging into my palm, on the hand that isn't there. All in my head, I guess, something with the nerves. And it's like that all the time. If I really concentrate, I can make it let up a little, but it goes right back that way a minute later. That little twinge of pain is always there, a couple of inches into space where my hand should be. I wake up with it. I thought about telling her my own tragic story of the scrotal candle wax incident, but figured it wouldn't impress her. She crossed her arms and rubbed the cold from them, and I put my arm around her to help. The gun was on the floorboard. I said, "You know I was confused when I first saw you, right? At the house? I didn't know where your hand went. Well, I still had it in school. But John knew." "Well, yeah," she said. "He used to come by." "Let me tell you everything you need to know about John. The reason I was surprised by your hand was because John never once described you as the girl with the missing hand." 5:36 a.m. I don't know what John did in the intervening time between when he left the mall and when he showed up at the Drain Rooter roofing site, but from past experiences with John, I will extrapolate that he told a series of humorous stories about his penis, drank some sort of off-brand alcohol, and then had sex with yet another girl who I secretly had a crush on but never got the courage to talk to. At some point, he also changed into his roofing clothes, layers of flannel and coveralls stained with tar. The semi-accident scene had been neatly cleared away by the time he passed it again, only a flat of tangled tire tracks as evidence. Steve, the roofing guy, was already at the rear of the building, talking to a security guard about roof access. This was one of the guards John saw at the trailer crash site. He didn't know if the guy would recognize him or not, so he took a newspaper from the trash and held it in front of his face as he approached. Again, this is just what John told me, so, you know, grain of salt. By 6 o'clock, 13 men in Steve's crew were swarming above and below the ragged roof hole, working as snow and ice runoff poured mini waterfalls into the Drain Rooter break room. The drenched carpet and waterlogged candy bar machine were ruined. John got on the roof and immediately saw that the hole was no ice collapse. Everything was flung upward, debris and boards and tiles scattered on the roof like something blew out from inside. Tyler Schultz, a big, blonde, Nazi youth-looking kid who had jammed with John's band off and on, made the same observation and said, "Wasn't that some weird shit?" John told Tyler that frequently during sudden cold spells, the warm air inside a heated building will expand, causing a building to partially explode for much of the same reason balloons will burst if you fill them with warm air rather than cool. Tyler asked John if he was making that shit up, and John said that he could look it up, knowing he wouldn't. John then took the stairs down to the wet break room, tape strewn across the hallways to keep employees from wandering in. The first thing he noticed was that the break room snack machine looked like it had been hit by a car, glass smashed in and shreds of candy wrappers all over the ground. While the guys were stomping around above him, getting a tarp set up and shoveling snow away from the ceiling wound, John wandered around and noticed a section of hallway that had been blocked off with the same black and yellow danger tape he saw earlier. For the second time that day, John ducked casually across some do-not-duck-casually-across-this-tape, and saw another hole, one in the wall, again like something blew through it, something the size of a car or a giant crab with a monkey strapped to the back of it. And at the edges of the hole, there were scars in the drywall, like scratches, claw marks. John leaned in and peered through the jagged tear in the wall. He saw a room that was clearly not on the floor plan. It was small, maybe the size of an average living room, and had absolutely no features. Four bare walls. Then John turned away from it and, as he did, saw a perfectly round hole in the floor as wide as the room, going down. Way down. John said it was the kind of chasm thing they have in all of the space stations in the Star Wars movies, for some reason. The ones crisscrossed with catwalks with no handrails. When he looked directly at it, it was not there, a tiled floor, just like at the mall. So the crab beast escaped from here. But the crew of guys sent to take it down returned to the abandoned mall. Everything came back to the mall, didn't it? John thought about Robert Marley, the soy sauce patient zero who had squatted in the food court, and about Danny Wexler ranting about invisible doors. John decided this whole thing required a shitload of further investigation. I splashed water over my face and studied my own bloodshot eyes in the mirror. glad to be back home, back in my bathroom. I pulled off my shirt and felt something catch back there, something itchy. I turned to the side and looked into the mirror at my back, my breath caught in my throat. There was something elongated, maybe a half inch long, protruding from my shoulder blade, thin like a needle, pink. Thump. A knock at the door. I leaned in close to the mirror, examining the growth and reaching back with my fingers, afraid to touch it. A shiver of revulsion twitched through my body. Thump, thump. A muffled voice at the door. David, hey. John's voice. What was he doing here? Thump, thump, thump. Hold on, I said, pulling up a hand mirror from the drawer in the vanity. I'll be out in a minute. I'm, shaving my balls. I held up the mirror, angled it to see the thing on my back, and almost screamed. The little protrusion on my back was a stalk that ended in an eye, a tiny black slug's eye that twitched as the stalk began curling this way and that, as if getting a look around. I jolted awake. Thump. I was cold, a searing pain in my neck. I smelled the sweet but artificial chemical smell of strawberry shampoo flavoring. Come to think of it, strawberries don't have a smell. They just smell wet like grass. Focus. I felt something like a steel cable around my chest. I couldn't move, a weight holding me flat. I pulled my eyelids apart, saw a set of eyes peering down at me through frosted glass. I blinked, looked down, and saw copper red, a head full of red hair on my chest. An arm was around me, squeezing, a fistful of my shirt, twisting it. I was lying with my head against the door of the Bronco, window roller pressing into my back, feet splayed across the bench seats, boot resting against the door across from me. Amy, however, looked rather comfortable since she had me to use as a self-warming mattress. She was curled up on top of me, breathing erratically, her eyelids twitching. Nightmares. Get used to it, kid. I craned my head and saw the blurred shape of John's face through a hole he had wiped clean of snow. He waved at me, standing there in full work gear, my watch. 8:07 a.m. My truck had died at some point because the engine and the heat were off. Amy and I untangled ourselves, and I pushed out of the door, standing up in the refrigerated air, joints feeling lined with thick steel wire. I glanced back into the truck and saw Molly fast asleep in the back, paws twitching as she dreamed of clawing somebody to death, probably me. John said, "It's your first date and you make the girl camp out at the donut shop with you? You know they don't open for 3 months, right?" There were five guys standing around aside from John, though Tyler was the only one I knew. They had come in two tall delivery trucks with Anderson Roof and Gutter painted on the side. I glanced at the strangers and said to John, We had to leave the house. Shouldn't you all be working? John said, "We had to get a load of shit from Home Depot. We've been fucking around for 2 hours. Passed by here and saw your truck. What happened at the house?" Amy came around then, arms wrapped around that huge parka of hers, and immediately pressed herself up against me. "Hi, John. Oh, I'm freezing." She reached back and pulled my arm around her, saying, "Warm me up." I gotta have a word with John. I grabbed her by the shoulders and sort of sat her aside, then motioned to John to follow me across the parking lot. We walked around the edge of the lot, me squinting as my eyes adjusted to the light. John said, "You look like shit." "I'm burning out, John. Seriously, I don't know if I'm up for this. I feel stretched out, like too little butter scraped over too much waffle. And then it all falls down into one of those waffle holes and there's none left for the rest of the waffle and you sort of have to tilt it to make it run out. They got some serious weird shit going on at the Drain Rooter plant, Dave. Mall, too." This was when John told me the somewhat dubious story of his experience at the semi-crash site and everything that followed. I saw his story and raised him our experience with the shadow people. I looked back at my truck, where Amy was sitting sideways in the open door and fishing through her purse. She pulled out a brown pill bottle. "Well, there you go, Dave. It looks like the Drain Rooter plan is making more than drain cleaner. In fact, you could say they're manufacturing evil." "No, we couldn't say that. I want to see where that hole goes. I think that monster came out of it." "We can't get into the place, John. There's three shifts at the plant working around the clock." We completed our circuit of the lot and arrived back where Tyler and one other guy leaned against the truck smoking cigarettes and sipping coffee from steaming insulated mugs. John said, "There may be another way."
John told me about the mall and the ghost door that was there, but wasn't there.
Want to know what I think? I think all those secret doors lead to the same place.
Hell, there may be doors like that all over town, like Wexler said.
I nodded resignedly, sighed, and said, well, we're not waiting for them to just come get Amy again.
Abso-fucking-lutely. We'll meet at noon.
What happens at noon?
We're done with the roof job. They just want us to brace it for now and cover it, keep the snow out.
You're still going to fix their roof?
They paid Steve in advance, plus I really need the money.
I noticed ghosts of exhaust rising from my Bronco. Amy had turned it on to get warm. I said, I don't know what to do with her. That house of hers is 18 different kinds of screwed. I glanced at Tyler, saw he was listening intently, and lowered my voice. She's got people watching her through the TV, like me. Amy saw us, and emerged from the truck at that moment, a 24-ounce bottle of Red Mountain Dew in her hand. She came up and said, can I have this?
You keep that red shit in your truck now?
John asked me.
I think that's one of the 12 warning signs, isn't it?
I eat all of my meals there at work. If you eat in your car, nobody tries to talk to you. John looked at me with something like pity. I said, it's yours, Amy. She twisted at the cap, shoulders hunched against the cold. Somebody handed John a cup of coffee. John said, break time.
Shit, yeah, said Tyler in his dickish way.
He was wearing wraparound shades. He watched Amy as she tried to open the Mountain Dew bottle one-handed, trying to keep it still with her elbow. She concentrated on the task, grunting, the wet bottle sort of spinning in place. I asked John, where's the safest place to keep her while we do this? Amy said, while you do what? Can I come? Tyler reacted to this for some reason, looking at John with a when are people gonna learn look, and then he spat on the ground. Tobacco spitting is a kind of nonverbal communication in many parts of the Midwest. He must have spilled his coffee a lot as a kid because he had one of those big spill-proof mugs, the kind that flare way out at the bottom. It looked like he was speaking into a megaphone every time he took a drink. I said, we'll talk about it later. Amy dropped the bottle, made a frustrated sound like somebody stepping on a cat. I reached out as if to help her, and she slapped at my hand, then went back to twisting at the cap. I continued, she can't go back to that house. I don't know if she has any money, but we can work something out. She can sleep on my couch if it comes to that. John eyed me as if to say, really, but didn't say anything. Tyler got a sly look in his eyes and said, I got an interesting story. My brother, he and his wife give birth to a Downs kid. He drools all over the place. He shits himself. They make my ma babysit a few times and then some more times. And then it was every night, every damn night. You know what happened then?
Your brain fell out?
I noticed Amy had stopped messing with the bottle and was sort of just looking at it, frozen. I said, look, I gotta...
Listen, man, listen. They left the kid there at my ma's house. They come by to visit every now and then. My ma, she's basically got stuck feeding and cleaning this thing now every day. It's her job. Full-time job. She can't go to her bingo games or date or any of that shit because she's got this thing to take care of. Because she wanted to be a nice person. It's like being in prison.
Amy glared at him, like she really had something killer to say to him. Then she got this look on her face, sour, like biting an apple and seeing half a worm. She spun and took two steps toward my truck, then put her hand over her mouth and leaned over. Tip, if you ever feel a puke coming on, do not put your hand over your mouth to try to catch it. It's reflex, but it doesn't work at all. Vomit kind of sprays everywhere. So Amy stood there in the snow, leaning over at the waist, her eyes clamped shut, her hand dripping, a puddle at her feet. It was an awkward moment. There were some comments from the crowd behind me. Somebody muttered something, and somebody else chuckled. I walked to her and said, over here. I guided Amy toward the truck and sat her in the open door. Don't move. I ran back to the rear door of the Bronco, opened it, reached in and grabbed a red and white flip-top cooler. This is my emergency kit. It contained a roll of duct tape, a spare pair of pants, an envelope with $200, two bags of dried fruit, two packages of beef jerky, three bottles of water, a roll of those thick shop towels you see mechanics use, a small metal pipe, just right for cracking a skull with, and a fake beard. Look, you never know. I pulled out a bottle of water and soaked a shop towel. I went to hand it to Amy, realized stupidly that she had no hand to take the towel with since she only had, you know, the puke hand and the non-existent hand. Here, I said. I took her arm by the wrist and wiped vomit from her fingers. Amy wrinkled her nose in disgust at this, but to be honest, I had never attended a party of John's where someone didn't either vomit on me or near me. I was kind of inured to it. As I worked, I said, "When I was in the 7th grade, I took Emily Parks to the fall festival. First time I had ever been anywhere with a girl. We wandered around and ate elephant ears and saltwater taffy and lemon shake-ups, all that festival stuff. We got on the Ferris wheel, and right as the ride is about to end, I lean over and puke in her lap. The ride slows to a stop, you know, so they can unload all of the riders. And we wind up at the very top, waiting. She's sitting up there with a lap full of vomit, crying, and we're up there forever." Amy's hands seemed pretty clean. I tossed the soiled rag in the snow and gave her a new one and the bottle of water. I stepped back and said, "I didn't ask another girl out until I was a junior in high school. 17 years old before I even held a girl's hand. All because somewhere in the back of my mind I knew I would wind up puking on her." Amy didn't react. She drank some water and wiped splatters of vomit off her pants and shoes, her fingers having to be frozen now, doing wet work in this weather. I caught a glimpse of her face and saw that look, a familiar look, a sort of embarrassment that is almost numbing, like she wanted to dig a hole, bury herself in it, and let grass grow over the top. A warmth spread behind my eyes. Everything turned red in my brain, my skull suddenly filled with Tabasco sauce. There was a tingling in my gut, muscles tensing. I picked up the used towels and walked back toward a trash can in the parking lot, near where Tyler and the guys were standing. I tossed the towels, and Tyler leaned over, whispering, "You're a nice guy, Dave, so all I'm saying is watch. That's all I'm saying. Watch out being a nice guy, because you can get fucked." A blink. A searing pain in my hand. Blood. There were arms on me, grabbing my jacket, pulling me. And there was blood on my knuckles and blood in my mouth. My jaws were clenched. I had bitten my tongue and tasted warm copper. Tyler was on his hands and knees, blood dripping from his nose and mouth, grunting that they had better hold me back because I was a fucking psycho and that I had broken his fucking nose. Then John was there, in my face, saying, "Okay, okay, back off. Just go, get out of here." I looked down at my throbbing hands and saw the knuckles were split, like I had been punching concrete. John pushed me back from the group, looked over my shoulder, and said, "Get him out of here." A fat blonde kid was standing over Tyler, looked like a bloated version of him, and I realized this was Tyler's brother or cousin or something. And the fat kid was saying, "See, see what happens when you run your fucking mouth, Tyler? That one day talking shit was going to get him killed, because he was going to say the wrong thing and some nigger was going to shoot him in the back." John turned and joined the group, and I was standing there in the parking lot by myself, lost, disoriented. Tyler outweighed me by 75 pounds, and where I spent my days shelving DVDs, he spent his days carrying roofs up ladders. But the strangest thing, the sickening thing, was the urge that flashed through my mind as I was standing over him. The urge to bite. And I knew this was it again, that I had lost time, that I had lost myself. Then I felt a pull on my jacket and the unique sensation of a handless arm reaching around my midsection. "Come on, come on, David." Amy circled around, her hand on my sleeve. "Amy, I... come on, it's okay. Come on." She started turning me back toward the truck, and I felt everyone staring. She got behind me and started pushing me toward the Bronco. "Come on, David. Take deep breaths, you're fine."
"Amy, don't..."
"Nope. Come on, keep going. Vroom." That last part was Amy making an engine sound as she steered me toward the truck like she was driving me. She reached around me and opened the door, then pushed me into the seat like you see cops doing with handcuffed suspects. She slammed the door, circled around, and sat in beside me. We sat that way for a moment. I glanced out my window and saw the whole group watching. I reached up with a shaking hand to twist the key and realized the engine was already running. I tried to slow my breathing. I couldn't keep my hands still. Amy asked, "Are you okay?"
"Just give me a second."
"You kicked that guy's ass."
"Amy,
come on, let's go before he gets up and beats the crap out of you." We got back to my house to find it ransacked. It was difficult to tell because I'm not the world's greatest housekeeper myself, but by the time I was in the kitchen, I knew they had been there. I don't normally keep the oven open. I whipped out the gun and prowled around the house, finding it empty. Amy asked what they were looking for,
I dodged the question by pointing out what a pity it was they tossed the place because it was immaculate before they got there, and that it was too bad she didn't get to see it when it was clean. I went to the kitchen and ran water over my bleeding knuckles.
Look, Amy said from behind me. They threw laundry all over your floor in there.
Yeah. And they wore the clothes first, the bastards.
And what were they looking for again?
A pause. I was on the verge of revealing what was probably our biggest and most dangerous secret to someone who I had known for all of a day. I let out a breath and looked right into her eyes. The irises were too green. That was the thing. Like grass after a week of spring rain. And there was a piercing electric intelligence in those eyes that I was too stupid to notice before. Seeing right through me. And I suddenly had the very dismaying realization that I probably could not lie to this girl. For one very simple reason. She was smarter than me. I said, "They were looking for the soy sauce. I know they didn't find it, though."
"The what?"
I didn't answer. I did a walk around the house, saw if anything was broken. It looked like they had taken the batteries out of my clock for some reason, and the glass fixture on my ceiling fan was cracked. Amy followed me around, pestering me with questions, suddenly desperately curious. The truth was, I wasn't sure how to explain it. After about the fifth time she turned the conversation to it, I held up a silencing hand, made a shushing sound, and put a single finger to her lips. "All will become apparent in good time, sweet Amy." For a second, I seriously thought she was going to punch me. I went outside and did a walk around to the house, glancing nervously at the tool shed and praying that the door wouldn't be standing open.
"What are you talking about, dipshit? If they came and took the body off your hands, that'd be a blessing."
I noticed the flag was up on my mailbox. This was Sunday. I went over and opened it, found a palm-sized package inside. There was no name, no address, no postage. I stared at it with some trepidation, then peeled it open, thinking it might be the world's tiniest mail bomb. Inside was a necklace, a little gold cross on a delicate chain. I had seen it before. Though seeing it close, I noticed that the cross was formed of two tiny nails, bound together by thread-like wire. There was a piece of paper inside, too, a folded piece of stationery bearing a cartoon puppy with a pencil in his mouth. The writing was in sparkly pink.
"Hi. I had a dream, and an angel told me to give this to you. It's always brought me luck. God bless. Smiley face. Chrissy Lovelace."
All of the eyes were dotted with big friendly loops. Everybody wants to help. When I went in, Amy was in the bathroom running water. She emerged, stuffing Altoid mints into her mouth from a tin. I went to the fridge and said, "You want something to drink? I have some fruity Leinenkugel's beer and some kind of terrible plum-flavored liquor John's friend from the Czech Republic sent him. It tastes like the juice from a single plum was squeezed into a 55-gallon drum of paint thinner." The cans of Leinenkugel's had masking tape on them with "John's" printed in ink. Amy looked around me and said, "John is protective about his beer, isn't he?" "I put that label on there. When company comes, I want them to know the Leinies is his, not mine. Do you want it?"
No, I don't drink," she said, shaking her head and brushing the hair from her eyes for the 400th time since yesterday. "I mean, I drink liquids, not alcohol. I couldn't mix it with the pain pills."
"So who do we tell about the monsters?"
What?
"All this, everything we saw. Who did we talk to about this sort of thing?"
"I think the government has an 800 number, but you just get one of those automated answering things. No, John and I are going to have to, look into it today, before they have a chance to come for you again." I closed the refrigerator and faced her, then told her an abbreviated and less retarded version of John's story about the Drain Reuter site and the Mall of the Dead. She said,
"Why don't we just go? To another town or state or Canada? When's the last time you heard of somebody exploding in Canada?"
I shook my head.
"Why not?"
"Because we're under the eye, Amy. There are things you still don't know. The shadow people, they've spoken to me. They know my name. It's personal, somehow, with them. I think trying to get away from that by leaving, even climbing into a rocket ship and leaving the fucking planet, would be laughable. To them, it'd be like watching a hamster trying to escape by running on his little wheel really fast. I picture the rest of my life. Running scared forever. No. I can't. I won't. We're going to go in there where they live. And we're going to go armed."
"I want to go."
"Amy."
"No. Don't even try. I want to see. I have a right to. Amy, we're going into that place with the intention of leaving it as a smoking hole in the ground. Praise be to Allah.
I know.
No, you think this is cool. I can see it in your eyes. It's not cool. We do not have this thing under control. Let me tell you a story. When I was little, we had our sewer line back up, toilet overflowing and all that. So they had to come and root it out, and what they pulled out of the sewer line was a woodchuck. There was a break in the pipe somewhere, two joints that had pulled apart, and this thing had gotten in, okay? I mean, to a woodchuck, this had to be the adventure of a lifetime, hidden tunnel seeming to go on for miles. So he's crawling and exploring and waiting to see the hidden treasure at the end. And then he gets drowned. In our poo. Amy nodded and said,
Well, that's sad.
The saddest. John and I, we're the woodchuck. See, I can read it on you, that you think you're really part of something now, that we're going to do something really great today and change the world. Well, Amy, understand what I'm about to say. There's something terribly wrong with us, John and me. Amy, there are days when I'm sure, sure, that I'm stone-cold, raving, batshit insane, that none of this is happening, that I'm raving about it from a padded room somewhere. And do you know how I respond to that, to the knowledge that I may be delusional and dangerous? I arm myself with a gun. David, you're not... Listen, the only reason I'm standing up to these guys now is because I'm in a corner. I don't have a choice. You do. And if you make the wrong choice, there is an excellent chance that these are your last hours on Earth. All the things you wanted to do with your life, they may not happen. All the things you like to do, all the things you thought you might like to do in the future, all gone. And it'll be because of me, because I led you into my turd pipe. She said,
Why do you, like, hate yourself?
If I knew me as somebody else, I would hate me just as much. Why have a double standard?
Well, that's just stupid.
I rubbed my eyes and sighed. I reached into my front pocket and pulled out the necklace and held it up. Here, it's good luck, or something. I went to Amy and reached around her neck, clasping the thin chain under her hair. I glanced out of the window, saw the snow was coming down again. Facing her, I said, You deserved some kind of normal life, Amy. I can picture you in college, a family back home. Maybe you're working part-time at a music store. Geeky guys coming in and flirting with you at the counter. And I could come in and make some kind of awkward conversation with you, and you could keep making excuses not to go out with me. And I would just keep coming back and back, and then you would get a restraining order against me, and my dad would get it overturned. Finally, you would agree, and we could go to a picnic or bowling or whatever normal people do when they're together. What do normal people do when they're together?
I have no idea.
It's funny. Pretending that it's normal to have a conversation with somebody standing 3 inches away. She leaned in and... It looked like the world outside my window had lost its signal and gone to static, snowing like hell, wind whipping it around. I leaned against my window, feeling the cold glass against my forehead, breaths fogging up a circular patch under my nose. There was a time when I would have found the idea of certain death a little comforting, like being on the last day of a job I hated. A weight lifted. Now, feeling the cold glass on my face and wet hair cooling my scalp and my mouth tasting vaguely like secondhand Altoids and knowing I would never see snow again, I felt a little like crying. But just a little. I saw the grill of a car emerge like a ghost, headlights faint in the whiteout. The big car swung into my driveway, John's caddy. Through the window I watched as John ducked out, wearing an army-issue fatigue jacket. He circled around to his trunk, popped it, and pulled out a canvas backpack. He slung it over his shoulder, and then pulled out a large tool that was unmistakably a...
Is that a medieval battle axe?
Amy asked from behind me, rubbing a towel through her hair. With John, we'll be fortunate if it turns out to be nothing stupider than that. The axe was a leftover from high school, when we used to be big into Dungeons and Dragons. Bear hunting. John burst in the door at that moment, dusted with snow, shouting, We are gonna fuck that place up. He tossed down his load with a force that shook the floor, then bent over and hefted the axe that I believe was one of several props he stole from that medieval-themed restaurant he worked at for a while. He paused to let his eyes flick to mine and Amy's wet hair, and presumably asked himself if our showers had overlapped in any way. He was too polite to ask. Then he turned and stepped past me into the hallway. He studied the wall, then raised the axe and swung it into the wall with a thock that sent plaster dust flying. He swung three more times, then thrust his hand into the hole he had created and pulled out a small object that fit in the palm of his hand. He glanced at it, wiped the dust on his shirt, then tossed it to me. I caught the small canister, silver, the size of a pill bottle. Amy saw it and asked, "What's that? You've never seen it before?" "Why would I?" "Big Jim had it at one time. We don't know where he got it, though." I quickly relayed to her the story of the weather guy in the mall and how he came across the container.
"So," she said, "what's in it?"
Chapter 15. D-Day. "Very simply," I said to Amy, "the reason we can see things that you can't is right there in that bottle. We don't know where it came from or what exactly it does. But in those first hours after you take it, your brain is tuned in like nothing you can imagine. Eyes like the Hubble telescope, sensing light that's not even on the spectrum. You might be able to read minds, make time stop, cook pasta that's exactly right every time. And you can see the shadowy things that share this world, the ones who are always present and always hidden. It'd be like if a doctor could walk around with microscopes strapped to his eyes all of the time, so he could just look and see the sickness crawling around inside us." Amy pointed out, "Well, he'd still have to be able to see inside your blood vessels and lungs and all that. A microscope wouldn't." "These microscopes also have some kind of X-ray vision attachment." She reached out and picked up the canister.
"Ugh, it's cold."
"The container is always cold," I said. "It refrigerates the contents 24 hours a day, and we don't know how. No batteries, no energy source. And it's been working for years. The sauce, it has to be kept cool or it becomes, unstable. Unstable in the way that a swarm of killer bees is unstable."
"And you're going to take it again?"
"I don't want to, but I think we have to. It'll level the playing field, get us on the same frequency as the bad guys. It's the reason we're alive."
"Oh, and everybody else who has ever tried it has wound up dead. The irony."
I said, "When I ran across this bottle, it was empty, just like mine." I opened the bottle and shook out the contents. Two capsules, black as licorice. "I bet you're wondering where these two came from. We're always wondering the same thing. The stuff seems to show up when it wants to." She said,
"You're not going to let me take any, are you?"
"I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. But you're not supposed to take it. If you were, there would be three capsules in here." John said,
"We better swallow these before they attack us."
We did. We waited.
"So," Amy asked, "how do you know when it's working?"
I said, "You just start noticing things. It's hard to explain. Like bits of radio signal coming in through the static." With that, a thought passed through my head, a flash like a shooting star. Pro wrestling was real, but not real in the sense that we perceive reality. It was more real than reality. Then I worked out pi to 4,000 decimal places and realized that if anyone ever drew a truly perfect circle, it would actually look like a straight line to our eyes. I looked at the silver pill canister and realized it was more than 4,000 years old, or less than 4 seconds. I said to John, "You know that if we walked around the world, your hat would travel 31 feet farther than your shoes?" John said,
"I don't know, Dave, but before we make a bomb, I have to shave half the dog."
I nodded. He got up, called to Molly, and herded her into my bathroom. I wondered when the soy sauce would take effect. To kill some time, I got up and hunted around the closet in my laundry room until I found my squirt gun. This was one of those huge modern guns, green and with a logo that said Big Gusher on the side. It had a separate 2-gallon tank with hooks for a belt. The commercials bragged it could spray a soaking quarter-inch wide stream of water for 50 feet, and that was pretty much true. The gun was sticky from when John and I filled it with beer last summer. I hunted around until I found a roll of duct tape and an extended disposable lighter, the kind people light grills with. I gathered 3 bottles of flammable chemicals that I would mix to form the fuel. I took my armload of items and dumped them on the table. Amy said,
"So, you're making a flamethrower?"
"Amy, we gotta be prepared. We don't know what we'll find in that place, but for all we know, it could be the devil himself."
"David, what possible good is that thing gonna do?"
"Oh no, you didn't hear me. I said it's a flamethrower."
"Girls."
"But if something is from hell, why would you use a—"
Amy stopped, apparently deciding against pursuing that question, and instead asked,
"What am I taking, when we go?
Is there a weapon or something for me? Have you forgotten the woodchuck already?
I went to work on the squirt gun. The sound of rustling and growling emerged from the bathroom. Under that, I could detect the low hum of my beard trimmer. Amy put her hand on mine, her other hand balled up in a fist on the table.
There was a sheep, she said. In Scotland, I think, and this sheep escaped from the ranch. And you know they shear sheep for their wool. Well, this thing stayed gone for 7 years. Finally, they found it in a cave. And there was nobody to shear the sheep, so when they found it, its wool was gigantic. It was like a walking afro. And it wound up back on the ranch, just another sheep. But for the rest of its life, it knew that for a while, it was free. It had that, and nobody could take it away. Do you understand? I'm like you. I want to face this thing, whatever it is. We're like that sheep taking our shot. If for no other reason than just to say we did.
I do understand. Trust me, I do. And it takes a special kind of person to make up something so utterly bullshitty. You know their wool doesn't just keep growing like that.
That's not even the point, David.
I went to take her other hand, saw my hand disappear into hers, and realized that it was because she didn't have another hand. But there it was, thin fingers wrapped in a tight ball. She looked down, curious, not sure what I was staring at. I said, "I think the sauce is working. Go put on the Scooby glasses. I want to try something." She got up, found them on the counter, then sat down, and I gestured to look at the spot where her hand shouldn't be. "Now this time, really concentrate. I don't know if..." No point in finishing the sentence. Her jaw hung open.
"Oh, I can see it. How is that possible?"
She tried it with and without the glasses, saw the hand appear and disappear.
"Look! My fingernails. I had let them get long, and I was meaning to cut them before I went in for the surgery. No wonder it hurts."
Then she lifted the clenched fist off the table and very slowly uncurled the fingers. She laid the hand flat on the table.
"David, this is crazy."
"I'm pretty sure that's about the least crazy thing you're going to see today." The bathroom door burst open. Molly came trotting out. The left half of her body had been shaved almost down to the skin. The right half was as shaggy as before. John emerged after that, brushing a layer of dog hair off his clothes. John said, "Well, that's done." Before I could stop her, Amy asked, "Why did you..." "It was Molly's idea. She wants to look like two different dogs when she's coming and going. She thinks it will make it easier for her to steal food." He turned to me. "That's one complicated dog, Dave. Have you started on the bomb?"
"The what?"
Society is doomed, for one very simple reason. It takes dozens of men working months with millions of dollars in materials to build a building, but only one dumbass with a bomb to bring it down. John and I had scavenged the house for bomb-making materials. Neither of us knew how to make a bomb prior to today, but we improvised one by analyzing the molecular makeup of the ingredients. My head was taking on a fiery soreness, cooking like an engine run too long and too hard. I wondered, not for the first time, if using the soy sauce would shave years off my life, and I realized that it probably didn't matter. So, using a packet of Jell-O, and the innards of two smoke detectors, and a pack of shredded playing cards, and the refrigerant from my truck's air conditioner, and 9 other ingredients, we fashioned a sticky explosive clay, mint green in color. We poured it into a tinfoil mold we made in the shape of a dog bone and stuck it in the freezer to solidify. The idea was to disguise it as something that would seem normal being in a dog owner's front pocket should we get caught and searched. I sat at the kitchen table, snapping brass bullets into the one spare magazine I had bought for the Smith. "Here's what I think," said John. "That facility, they've got to have some kind of intercom system. We sneak our way into the office where the mic is and put the boombox in front of it. We go right for the fucking jugular. November rain on a loop. While they're all holding their ears and begging for forgiveness, we go find this Korok fucker and shove the bomb right up his ass, or we get him to eat it, if it turns out he's a huge dog." I nodded and stood. The real plan, the unspoken one that hid between John's words, was that we would die. But we would die in the middle of what Korok's people would remember as the single most retarded and baffling incident in their history. We would be their Guy Fawkes. They would create a holiday about us. If we were going to wind up in the belly of Korok,
Might as well see if we could make him choke on the way down. Me and John, I mean, not Amy. I let out a long breath and put on my coat. I dropped in the gun and the spare magazine. John threw on his army jacket and leaned over, unzipped the backpack, and pulled out a chainsaw. He had tied a length of bungee strap to it so he could carry it slung over his shoulder. He then picked up the homemade flamethrower, not questioning for a moment what it was or what it did. He flicked on the lighter, and a delicate tongue of flame licked out in front of the barrel. He nodded in approval and blew it out, then grabbed the battle axe off the floor and handed it to Amy. She managed to hold it aloft in her one hand for exactly 2 seconds before she let the head clang to the floor. She let go of the handle, then dug some chapstick from her pocket and smeared it on her lips. We were loading up the Bronco when John reminded me of the exploding dog bone. I ran inside, pulled it out of the aluminum foil mold, and walked into the yard with it in my hand. I probably should have seen this next part coming. Molly ran over, half-shaved and half-shaggy, and snatched the bone from my fingers. At John's request, I'll skip over this next part, which involved us chasing the dog around the yard for a very long time, and finally John tackling her, prying open her jaws, and finding no remnant of the exploding bone in there. I began to walk away from the situation in disgust when a snow-covered John, still on the ground with Molly, said, "Look!" He was holding up Molly's front paw. I saw nothing unusual about it, but then realized the pie-like symbol we had seen on the carcass of the exploded Molly was missing from this dog's paw. Molly licked her nose and sneezed. John stood up. Molly flipped onto her feet and trotted away. I said, "What do you think it means?" "Hell, I don't know. We need the bone bomb back. Take the chainsaw and cut open the dog." Amy objected to this and came up with what I thought was a far more disgusting plan of trying to flush the bone from the other end of Molly. She went inside and dug out 2 convenience store burritos from my freezer and heated them in the microwave until they were lukewarm. After feeding both burritos to Molly and seeing no immediate results, John said, "All right, let's go. We're going to be late for our certain death." Whiteout. There was more snow than air in the atmosphere. We went 15 miles an hour through town. The whole place shut down under the storm. It was, I thought, an actual blizzard. I'd never seen one. About halfway there, John squinted into his rearview mirror. What the hell? Red and blue lights swept across the frosted rear window. We all glanced at each other, figuring we could either pull over or plow through the snowstorm for the slowest police chase since OJ. I pulled over, the 2 tires ramping up onto mounds of roadside snow. A blue, bear-like figure strode up to the driver's side door. I rolled down the window and felt freezing bits of snow land on my cheek. A face leaned down. I saw it and felt myself tense, my hand going right to the butt of the Smith. Oh, crap.